As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Instead of taking up that gym membership that you wouldn't use even if the gyms were open, how's about subscribing to The Athletic for just £4 a month as a New Year's resolution? You'll get unrivaled football coverage with analysis and in-depth features from the very best writers around, exclusive Q&As with Athletic staff, and ad-free versions of all of The Athletic's podcasts, including this one. Find out more and sign up today at theathletic.com/totally.
Totally Football Show. Today, Phil Foden and the champions folding as Alisson has his worst night at Anfield since that time with Roma. 4-1 City, is that it for the title? Also, all tied at Old Trafford, 9-man Newcastle against Saints, and you don't have the authority, Mike Dean. Ref can't tell arse from elbow with VARs on elbow. We check out the Suchet controversy and so much more in this Totally Football Show in association with Paddy Power. Hello there, listener. It's Monday the 8th of February. Thank you so much for joining us here on The Totally. We've got Michael Cox in, aka Zonal Marking. Hello, Michael.
Hi, James.
Daniel Story's with us too, from The Eye and Football 365.
Hi, James.
Mr. Winners and Losers.
Mm-hmm, indeed.
Sasha Gurionov from Oku Sports. Sasha.
Hi, James.
Hi. Sasha, this season's title race wrapping up early as well, I see.
Oh, it is. It's over. It's all over.
Are you sure, Sasha? Because, I mean, I'm old enough to remember various other truths universally acknowledged that this season has provided over the last couple of months, like when Man United were definitely going to win the title, and that time when Spurs beat Man City themselves. When was that? November. And then Spurs went top of the table and everyone was like, oh my God, Mourinho's a genius and he's going to win the title. Are you sure that this time around it's going to stick?
Well, James, you very kindly didn't remind me of the time that Liverpool won 7-0 and I thought they were going to win the title. That was under 2 months ago. And Liverpool have won 2 games since. But it feels that the season was going to be won by a team that can put a run together. And Man City have just won 10 straight. And to be honest, if they hadn't won 10 straight, if they maybe have drawn 2 or 3 of those games, they would be back in the pack. But them's the differences. And it looks they've sorted out their defense. They have a lot of players fit. They're operating very well, even without Kevin De Bruyne or really a striker, by just playing loads of midfielders going forward and the midfielder at left back as well, if you like. And they just they picked up the points against the weaker sides. Actually, I looked at the games that they won over the last 10 games. Liverpool have dropped a lot of points against those very same sides. And I think that's why we see City going clear at the top and Liverpool just plummeted down the table.
Right, bullying the weaker teams, just like today at Anfield. We'll get on to the big game between Liverpool and Man City in a second or two, just to quickly run you through the scores. Saturday, Aston Villa beat Gunners 1-0. Burnley Brighton finished 1-1. It was 3-2 and deja vu for Saints at Newcastle as they lost again. Jan Bednarek scored an own goal again, but this time it was their opponents who went down to 9 men. No goals, but in a Mike Dean red card controversy at Fulham West Ham and a thriller at Old Trafford. Everton 2-0 down at halftime, levelling 3-3. With the final kick of the game. Sunday, Kane was back for Spurs and on the score sheet again with Son in a 2-0 win for Tottenham over West Brom. There were no goals at Molineux for Wolves and Leicester. City were 4-1 winners at Anfield and Sheffield Chelsea ended 2-1 to the Blues. which means City are 5 clear with a game in hand. Liverpool now 4th, only 1 point ahead of Chelsea and West Ham. And the bottom three, who remain Fulham, West Brom and Sheffield United, are now 8 adrift.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of the Athletic Podcast Network.
Big game Sunday was at Anfield, Liverpool, Man City.
I think it'll get to that point with Foden eventually where he'll start to play in that David Silva role more central.
Like Alan Partridge stepping on a spike, yeah.
Oh my word, the magnificent commentary there of Martin Tyler and in particular Jamie Carragher. As City got on their way to a 4-1 victory, their first win at Anfield since 2003. Liverpool with 3 straight defeats there for the first time since 1963. And they now have 27 fewer points than they did at the same stage last season, which is the biggest drop by any reigning champion at this point of a campaign in top flight history. Wow. All right, so 4-1, and the second half in particular, a performance from City that had the whiff of history about it.
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. I think Guardiola got it right. Sometimes we accuse him, understandably and fairly, I think, of kind of overthinking these big games. But by leaving Gabriel Jesus out and by playing those band of merry attacking midfielders, I think he really got into Fabinho's head. Fabinho's been great over the last few months at filling in, but I think he's been better when he's had a kind of focal point centre forward that he can look after and almost do a man marking job like he might do in central midfield. But not knowing who to pick up. There was that period early in the second half where he kind of stuttered a bit, didn't know to track Foden, ended up tracking him, got done down the wing and picking up a yellow card for having no choice but to bring him down. And I think that really, yeah, that kind of sold the game. Of course, Alisson's mistakes were important too. But yeah, I think City were brilliant. And Phil Foden, you know, I've just written, it felt like a coronation for him. It really did. This felt like his breakout game of his breakout season.
I also felt that as the game went on, City figured out how to isolate particularly Trent. And the fact that when Fabinho came over to cover him, he wasn't, again, as Daniel mentioned, not a centre-back covering. So therefore, you know, he leaves a dangling leg to give away the penalty and really, you know, exposed very superbly by City today. However, I think given how the game progressed, I think we saw as well that, I mean, for me, the drop-off from Liverpool after halftime was sort of a surprising and not surprising, because I thought they were actually fairly comfortable in the first half, had a couple of chances. But I think what we've seen this season, particularly of late, is Liverpool seem to be unable to maintain this sort of psychological sharpness throughout the 90 minutes. They used to be able to do it before. They used to be kind of be able to build up pressure on teams until they cracked. And now they kind of just drift away. And I think, weirdly, we've started seeing it, I think, post-Christmas, you know, when they drifted away against West Brom. And in the game since, I thought they kind of recovered it against Spurs and West Ham, but as the last two games showed, maybe that good form was just a blip. And I think, you know, if you look at, I mean, you know, the centre-backs have been done to death and, you know, the fact that they got the two main central midfielders playing at centre-back. However, chopping into all those changes have completely imploded their formation. And perhaps, you know, in a time like this, when you might want to be able to, you know, play according to your instinct, they can't because the players are all in the wrong positions.
Was it Liverpool switching off after halftime, or was it the fact that, a little bit as Guardiola commented afterwards, that his team kind of switched on? Phil Foden started doing what Guardiola had asked him to do. Alisson kind of paved the way for them, or at least the combination of Alisson and Liverpool's makeshift back line kind of opened up the door for City, and City just kind of kicked on.
Yeah, I mean, Guardiola changed system at half-time, moved from rough 4-3-3 to more of a 4-4-2 without the ball. And I think that certainly helped stop Alexander-Arnold's breaks down the right, because as Sasha says, I think he was very threatening in the early stages. But I slightly disagree with Daniel, because I didn't really understand what Guardiola was trying to do with his first half system. I was surprised by the team he picked with the two fullbacks. I thought he was going to pick Laporte and be a lot more solid down that side. So, yeah, I think the change of system really did improve City. I think it was probably three things that swung the game. One was the change of system. Two was Alisson. And the other thing was that Foden, I just thought, was brilliant. I mean, he was filled in that central striker role. But I thought the most notable thing about him was he did a bit of everything. You know, he dropped deep from that position really well. There was one point where he barged Fabinho off the ball when they were contesting an aerial, which got given as a foul. But even then, you know, it's almost quite impressive that Foden can foul Fabinho in the air. He also put in a great cross from the left. That just evaded Sterling. And then when he went to the right, he went down the wing to create the second goal and then obviously scored a brilliant fourth goal. So, you know, we all know Foden is a brilliant talent and has been very good this season, but I think we saw something more than what we've seen before, just a real all-round attacking talent who can seemingly play in any attacking position.
We have to remember, he's still only 20. Well, he's younger than Jadon Sancho, who feels like the kind of hallmark of young English attacking exciting talent. And fair play to Guardiola, because I'm happy to admit that I didn't think he should go out on loan, but I did doubt whether he might get the regular minute. You know, 6 months ago I was wondering, does he go to the Euros? Does he get enough minutes to go to the Euros? Now we're all thinking, which position does Southgate start him in the first game? Because he really has kicked on that much and been allowed to kick on that much with the, you know, with the departure of David Silva.
And also compliments to Foden as well, his presence of mind seizing on the sort of second Alisson error, if you like, for the first goal, because he knew exactly where to go straight away and that he just needed to get down to the byline and get the ball across, because Liverpool were completely out of shape. I mean, and I don't think at that stage City were necessarily pressing the Alisson kicks, but they certainly were 2 minutes later and Alisson went to pieces. You know, it's... I looked at that and I think that is A, very atypical, and B, I'm thinking maybe there's still after effects of the illness, because the decision making in those moments was so astonishingly catastrophic that A, Liverpool couldn't come back after that, and B, it'd be interesting to find out exactly what was wrong with him, because that was really bad.
Klopp mentioned the temperature as well, which I know Roy Keane wasn't having any of, but it was really cold, and when you're a keeper, Sash, you don't get the chance to keep warm the way the others do.
That is true, but he hasn't done anything this bad before. I like this. Right. This was outstandingly atrocious by him.
Unsung hero. Was curious about whether other teams are now putting pressure on the way Liverpool play out from the back, and maybe that's what City were trying to do a little bit. And also whether his lack of confidence or his errors were because of the fact that it's two unnatural centre halves playing in front of him.
I don't. The thing that really surprised me with Alisson, and Klopp actually mentioned it after the game, he kind of said, sort of brushing it aside with a joke as he tends to do, he sort of said, he was asked what he told Alisson. He said, well, the stands are there, you can use them if you want. As in to say, after the first error, to then get it to feet, right, having already made another sort of half error, to then again try and play it so short and get it so badly wrong. I know teams believe in the process and Klopp is one of those managers, but I'm so surprised he didn't just knock that a little bit longer to kind of make himself feel better more than anything else.
Yeah, equally his teammates might have not passed it straight back to him like 2 minutes after conceding that.
I just want to say on City, the one thing I thought was really impressive, and I know Michael wrote about this a lot when they were winning their titles, is they probably scored all four of their goals from 6 yards or less today, which was the hallmark of City's attacking unit in full flow. And I know this has been kind of founded on the defence, this re-rise, but that to me was the ominous sign for everyone else. The fact that Sterling and Gundogan and Foden were getting so close to goal and being happy to pass six, you know, that Sterling pass to Foden was 7 yards from goal with three Liverpool players around him. That's the ominous sign for everyone else, because that's the sign of City in rude health.
Yeah, I completely agree with Daniel, in part because he was agreeing with me. But he scored, I mean, if you go back to the Burnley game in midweek, Gabriel Jesus was, his goal was an open goal really, albeit a rebound, and the second one was just a classic Sterling tap in from 4 or 5 yards. I've lost count of how many goals he scored like that. So yeah, they are putting a lot of chances on a plate, and I think when they're at their best, they do that better, probably better than any team I've ever seen.
Well, 14 straight wins, 10 straight in the Premier League, 5 points clear with a game in hand. Now as for Liverpool, how bad might it get? Andy Jennings asked, was the price Liverpool have to pay for winning the title the fact that the very next season they missed the top four by finishing below their City rivals, their fiercest rivals, their modern rivals, and their former manager? Woof, speaking of which, they're at Leicester next weekend. What do you think, Sash? A lot of people talking about top four and it's in doubt.
I think it's worth refocusing, you know, getting the title clear out of your mind and refocusing on the top four. I think, you know, the battle for top four at the moment is such a mess because, you know, a couple of wins and completely changes. But Liverpool, I mean, they have almost a week now until the next game. They go to Leicester. And if anything, what they do this season is they win in cities beginning with L. They've only won in Liverpool and in London so far in the league. But I think I thought they might have used Christmas to kind of recover and recoup because they had 8 days off and then they fell apart. So I think now it's almost, you could see that there is, a lot of psychological fatigue in what they're doing. So I think they need to basically psychologically rebuild themselves. Plus, of course, they need to do something about those centre-backs because even though, say, for example, against Spurs and West Ham, I went to those games, Jordan Henderson was really, really impressive at centre-back. The games like today and games like, I don't know, like Brighton, then you can see how he's really missing it from that midfield. Again, I think we saw a thing like that happen in the City last season when Fernandinho was suddenly playing centre-back. I mean, in Liverpool's case at the moment, there's two midfielders playing centre-back. So it's completely disbalanced. I think it also feels like very unfair on Thiago Alcantara because I think he's coming into a midfield with also fullbacks out of form that he didn't really expect to play in like this. So I think also with him over the last few games, you kind of see the zip, the zest, the class kind of that you like, you know, like the old cliche of oozing class when he gets on the pitch. It's kind of evaporated to the extent that now he's almost not that unrecognizable, but he certainly just doesn't influence the games as he was supposed to.
Right. I mean, there's been a lot of question marks about his impact on the team and on their results and how well he fits in. Football 365 describing him as a Guardiola player in a Klopp team, which I don't know how you would react to that. Michael's not having any of that. I did want to ask a broader point, though. This group's been together quite a long time now, and I think everyone would imagine that they'll need to freshen it up a bit, bring in some fresh blood, some mental freshness as well. To what extent have their plans for rebuilding the team been completely scuppered or severely compromised by the kind of global situation with coronavirus and the fact that nobody's going to pay them big bucks for the likes of Mane and Salah?
Well, I mean, we don't know that anyone won't pay them big bucks for those. I think, to my mind, this whole Liverpool re-rise to prominence started when they sold Philip Coutinho, when it enabled Klopp to do that. It enabled him to rebuild.
Because they got a ludicrous amount of money from a La Liga club.
Yes.
Which, I mean, the assumption was that they'll probably try and do that again or probably be happy to accept that again for one of those players up front.
Yeah, but I don't think they need as big a rebuild as they did at that point. I do believe it's psychological more than anything. Klopp has always excelled as a pursuit manager, as a chasing manager. And for 3 years, Liverpool had that carrot of, you know, trying to get back into the elite, which they did by reaching the Champions League final, then trying to atone for it, then trying to atone for finishing second in the Premier League. And it is a completely different business. Even when he even at his best at Dortmund, they were always chasing Bayern Munich. So he always had that chase. And I think the key question is whether he feels that it's going to take another 2-3 years to rebuild or whether what happens at Dortmund, which is that it all went a little bit stale quicker than everyone expected.
Mm. Or knowing this season, it could just be a couple of months. After all, it wasn't long ago the City with the burnouts who were needing a total refresh. Sorry, Michael.
Just one quick point about the defence. I know they conceded 4 goals here, but it was 2 really big goalkeeping errors and they were up against the best team in the league. They haven't conceded more than 1 goal in the league since October the 17th. So I understand that the lack of defenders is affecting them, I think, probably more on the ball than off the ball.
Right.
But they're not actually conceding many goals. I mean, they conceded 7 goals in a game when they had their first choice centre-backs available. So I think people are being a little bit concentrating too much upon this this game when they're talking about the lack of centre-backs. I think in general, defensively, they've been all right.
But the issue with the centre-backs, I might be missing the point here, is the fact that, yes, they are managing to cover at the back by using their midfielders, but it's what it just does to everything else that they do by losing those talents in midfield.
Sure, I get that, but I'm not really sure what the solution is. I mean, Van Dijk will be coming back. Gomez will be coming back. They couldn't go out and sign a world-class centre-back, in my opinion, because then, it's just not the right allocation of resources. I just think they've been a little bit unfortunate. Their centre-backs have been out injured, and I think they've coped as best as they can. Personally, I put their poor form down to what Sasha said. I think they're probably just a little bit mentally fatigued. But yeah, I think their defensive record in general has been pretty good, and I don't think we should forget that.
I think also what I would add, I think one person who could make a difference in the coming weeks is Jota, because I thought Jota was the guy for the future. I didn't think he was going to feature as importantly as he did this season. It turned out he was pretty key. So I think him returning will allow... I mean, he basically, I think when he plays, he moves in a slightly different way to the others. I think also he hasn't been studied by the opposition as much. So therefore, those defensive teams that Liverpool come up against, they don't quite know how to look after him. So he catches them by surprise. So I think his return and then him staying fit until the end of the season, I think would actually be very important.
All right, City though, the big question, who's going to take penalties going forward? Pep Guardiola once again considering Edison for spot kick duties. When I commented 6 months ago, it was a joke, said Pep. Now it's a half joke. We really don't have a specialist in this area. Remarkable.
No, I mean, it was actually last January that he first said it. And actually, it didn't. He didn't really say it as a joke. He might have meant it as one, but he was deadly serious when he said that Edison was their best penalty taker. And yeah, I mean, he praised Kevin De Bruyne and he praised Ilkay Gundogan's penalties, but they both missed the target against Liverpool this season. The Gundogan penalty was bizarre. I think he got spooked a little bit by Alisson guessing the right way and which meant he lifted it higher than he wanted, kind of afraid of hitting Alisson. But it was a dreadful penalty, but it was.
Right. Gundogan tweeting after the game, 3 points for a field goal, Super Bowl tonight, or something along those lines. Or at least Man City's social media department. Anyway, now, up next, with City in action midweek at Swansea and Liverpool not in action midweek, but watching at home. We'll move on to the barnstorming Saturday night spectacular at Old Trafford between Everton and Man United.
Now, sir, remember, a tattoo is permanent, so tell me one more time what you want. Well, I want Bruno Fernandes knocking a live bird off its perch with a free kick, with Ollie as a kind of like god in the sky. Oh, and Champions 2021 on top as well.
I can't see anything going wrong there, Man United fan. But if things don't go exactly as expected, Paddy Power's Acca Insurance gets you a free bet if one leg of your 4+ fold Acca lets you down. Paddy Power! Max free bet £10, min odds 1 to 5 on each leg. Online exclusive, excludes shop bets, excludes enhanced match odds. T's and C's apply, 18+, begambleaware.org.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This is the Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. The Athletic is the only place you can read articles by Daniel Taylor, Amy Lawrence, Phil Hay, James Pearce, Ollie Kay, and the very best football writers around.
This just in from our 2-0 is a dangerous scoreline department. Man United 2-0 up at halftime in their clash Saturday against Everton, pegged back at the death by the Toffees. Woof, what a game this was. Drama, great goals, that final twist. Michael, did you enjoy it?
It was a weird game. It was great drama, and yet I spent the vast majority of the game thinking, this is dead, this is over, you know, this game isn't really live. I've no idea how Everton got a point from this. They played well for about 5 minutes of the second half, and that was it. Awful before halftime, just technically so bad. James Rodriguez, I thought, looked unfit. And then I found Manchester United strange as well, because... I mean, Manchester United are strange in so many ways, but the way I find them most strange is that they're a side who specialise on the counter-attack, which we know. And so usually sides like that, they're quite good when they're leading games because the opposition come onto them and then they can break in behind. And they've struggled a little bit before that. But they're the opposite. I mean, Manchester United keep on going behind and then coming back, which isn't a usual quality of a counter-attacking side. And here they were leading for the majority of it. And I didn't think created that much at all. I mean, it was one of those games that was hugely entertaining, I thought, really because of both sides' inadequacies. Albeit there were two moments of brilliance for Manchester United in the first half for the two goals. I mean, the Rashford cross was superb for Cavani. And then Fernandes, maybe that is one of the goals of the season. But yeah, a very strange game. It was the game of all the games I've seen recently, it was the one where I thought, yeah, a lot of these players are really, really tired.
Fernandes lets it run to Aaron Wan-Bissaka and then gets it back. Fernandes goes for goal! Oh. And what about that? That is spectacular!
What was the Fernandes goal like, the Cantona effort or not?
I think if they'd have just that. If they'd have just recorded just the finish.
Yeah.
Yeah, if they just recorded the finish and then right. The kind of sort of deliberately muted celebration of kind of look around what I've done, maybe, but the build-up was absolutely, I mean, night and day different. So No, it wasn't.
Even the finish, right. I'm not having a drive being the same as a chip. I don't get that at all. You don't have to relate everything back to something that happened in the 1990s. It's fine.
Everton, just three shots in this game, but they scored with all three. And a lot of people suggesting this is why United are never going to win anything.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a slightly, I mean, that's a deliberately kind of extremist view of it. But it has a point in reality, which is that United haven't scored from open play against a big six side in 11 months, which means that there will be more pressure on every other game they play against the rest. Because they pretty much, to keep pace with City, have to win every other game. And so when they don't, you know, when they slip up against Sheffield United, when they should be Everton and don't, it will inevitably invite more pressure because of their reticence to attack against other teams, I think.
It's also about the goalkeeping, because I think Solskjaer is perhaps beginning to lose his patience in the post-match interview. He says, can't concede a goal every time there is a shot between the posts. I think that's a criticism of De Gea. And I think it's about time they're actually making the decision for Henderson, because, again, De Gea in this game, obviously, he gives the first goal away. And the way he comes out to block the third one against Calvert-Lewin, he does not attempt to clean out the player or to make himself big. If anything, he kind of hesitantly makes himself small, which suggests, I think that's very, very problematic. And I've advocated for this earlier this season that Manchester United need to make this decision, and I think they need to put Henderson in goal now.
Or maybe we'll see him midweek when Man United take a West Ham in the cup. It wasn't entirely his fault, though. There was, I mean, Harry Maguire, I think, also contributes on that third goal, which was a pretty magnificent moment for any neutrals watching.
Yeah, goalkeeper up as well, which is always good. Yeah, I mean, Maguire was at part fault for two of the goals, in that he let Calvert-Lewin run behind for the first, and he held the wrong line. He held held a different line to every other Manchester United defender for the third. But the second goal was the one, I think, that was the kind of collective calamity. It reminded me of Sheffield United's winner, in that the ball goes loose and it feels like Manchester United are playing a second behind everyone else, because they just reacted so slowly. And then somehow James Rodriguez, despite Manchester United not rushing out to the ball, still left James Rodriguez in 5 yards of space in the penalty area. That's kind of a hard one to work out.
Mm. All righty, Man United have West Ham in the cup. Everton are up against Spurs. That West Ham game, quick mention for their trip to Craven Cottage, which ended goalless, but the red card for Thomas Suchek has excited plenty of comment. Michael?
Yeah, I thought that was crazy. I thought it was another example of, if you watch something 30 times on slow motion, you read so much more into it than if you watch it once at full speed. I don't know. I felt...
Is it like when you say the word lorry 10 times in a row and it just loses the noises stop making any sense? Is it a similar principle?
Yeah, I guess so. I just felt this one, I just kind of laughed at, because it was the 96th minute and I think it was pretty much the last action of the game, and it was just like, you just have to despair of it. It'll be interesting to see what happens with the appeal, because there have been a couple of instances where VAR have, you know, they've given a decision having watched a replay 30 times and it still gets overturned when someone watches it another 30 times. I thought that was dreadful, really. Yeah,
I think it's karma. When I went to West Ham Liverpool, I was waiting for him to come out to do his post-match flash interview, and he never did, and you know, we went off air, and I have been thinking bad thoughts about Tomáš Souček, even though I am generally a fan. But
quite a delayed reaction, Sash, given that he scored six goals in his last
but it might not have been to snub you, Sash.
No, I don't know what it was, but everyone else.
Okay.
But I took it really personally, and I cycled all the way there. I cycled all the way back, and the only person I spoke to was Jurgen Klopp.
Okay. That's not too bad, huh?
Yeah.
Wow.
Not the only person I spoke to.
Anything else you want to add about Fulham 0, West Ham 0?
I like Fulham. I'm really a big fan of Fulham. I think their play, I think that's ever since that 1-1 draw with Liverpool, like I've really noticed how they've sort of changed up the system. And I just think they're just terribly unlucky. They need to pick up a couple of wins. They've drawn, I think, since last 11, they've drawn 8, lost 3. And those 3 defeats, they could possibly consider themselves unfortunate in 2 of them. And it just feels like a couple of wins and they... That gap is opening up, I think, between them and the teams above. So they have the danger of being sucked into that relegation zone and possibly losing their way. And I hope they don't, because I enjoy watching them play. And I think I have a lot of admiration for Scott Parker and the way he learned through this season. He'd improved the team after the terrible early start. He just needs a couple of wins.
Right. They are in the relegation zone, Sash. Just put up. They are
I meant the gap between them and whatever the
17th. It's 8 points now. Enjoy them while you can. That's my thinking. Obviously, this season, nobody knows what's going to happen. Everton, as I mentioned in the Cup midweek, have Spurs. Mourinho cares about the FA Cup. That's very much his brand. And Spurs welcome back Harry Kane as well, which means they're a football team again, and demonstrated that against mighty West Brom on Sunday. Thursday, though, they put in one of the worst performances I think we've seen from any team all season. Against Chelsea.
Yeah, just a complete lack of any intent. And, you know, we're used to Mourinho setting up as a kind of risk-averse safety first, but we're used to it forming part of a plan rather than just because it feels like nobody's bothered to tell them to work on a game plan, which is what it looked like against Chelsea. They were better against West Brom, but West Brom defended pretty well for the first half, actually, but they allow so many shots that eventually... You know, they're not good enough to defend to keep it out. And Kane did look bright. I'm not surprised that Mourinho brought him back quickly. I'm surprised that he looked so sharp so quickly. I mean, he missed a couple of chances in the first half, but his interchange of play was actually, you know, what we might expect, which is good for Spurs. But I mean, they're still... I don't think we can say it too strongly enough that they were only playing West Brom at home.
Okay. And are you concerned at all about how quickly Kane has come back again?
As an England fan, I am slightly concerned, yeah. Although it wasn't a muscle thing, was it? Which is...
Ankles. No, but both of his ankles, basically. I don't know. I mean, they're quite delicate things.
It doesn't seem like a thing you can fake fitness. And he looked pretty fit on Sunday. Therefore, I think we have to assume he's fit. A shout out to Sam Allardyce, who hasn't really organised a defence that well at West Brom, but cannot be faulted for his logic. Because after the game, he said he was asked about, you know, what West Brom had to do to stay up. And he said, well, the thing is, we need to win some games. And it's hard to do that if you keep on losing, which is watertight. I've checked and it's watertight.
West Brom are very much in the bottom three alongside Fulham and Sheffield United, who once again look spirited in their clash Sunday evening with Chelsea, but were defeated 2-1. And in a world of trouble down there.
Maybe it's the obvious analysis, but just a lovely goal from Mason Mount. I thought the timing of his run, the fact he was in that goal-scoring position, a really crisp finish. I mean, a lot of people seem to think that with Lampard leaving, that was, you know, he might be out of the team, especially because they got so much competition for that number 10 role he played. But he's had a brilliant couple of weeks under Tuchel, and I think really has... People just won't speak about him like that anymore, will they? People now must realise he's just a brilliant player, regardless of the manager.
Remember the reaction to the first game? Oh, he left Mount out. Oh, what's Mount going to do now? And obviously he's featured every time since, and he's been very, very good in the system.
All in all, things going pretty well then for Chelsea, with the exception of that one moment from Antonio Rudiger. And shaping up to be quite a clash that they'll have in 10 days' time with Atletico Madrid as the Champions League returns. Very good. More from the Premier League and a throw forward to the FA Cup and more coming up on this Totally Football Show.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Smart Speaker, and now ad-free on The Athletic. This is The Totally Football Show with James Richardson.
Hey, listener, if it's Monday the 8th of February for you, congratulations, because it's exactly 21 years since perhaps the greatest football headline of all time was written. Supercaligo-ballistics, Celtic are atrocious.
And they this are again.
Yeah, they are again. Well, I'm not laughing about that. But are they atrocious? You can find out by listening to the Zodiac Scottish Football Show, which is out on Tuesday. That headline, anyway, all the way back in whenever 21 years ago was followed the Hoops getting beaten 3-1 at home by the then part-time Inverness Caledonian Thistle in a Scottish Cup tie. Magnificent stuff. By the way, there's actually a piece going up on The Athletic later on this week, hypothesising about how Celtic and Rangers would do if they were in the Premier League. Michael, did you contribute to that? I know you're a big fan of hypothesising.
No, I look forward to reading it, though.
Right. I wonder what they say. What would your guess be?
Well, my guess would be that in the short term, they would probably struggle because I'm not sure they have the calibre of players, but long term, they've got the supporter base and the attendances when things get back to normal to think they would be challenging near the top of the league. I mean, to give a caveat to the first bit of that, Rangers do look a really good team this year. Mm. They know more than me, so I will genuinely read the piece.
Excellent. Okay. Also out this week is the Offside Rule WSL edition after a big weekend in WSL, Michael.
Yeah, I mean, biggest day of the season so far. It was an incredible day, really. I mean, WSL, really, the pattern is that the big four don't really lose to anyone else. And that was completely broken today with Chelsea suffered their first loss in 2 years. They'd just won 33 games unbeaten, which was a WSL record. They lost to Brighton, who hadn't won since November, had recently lost 7-1 to Man City and 3-0 to bottom of the league, Bristol City. Funny game, all three goals from corners, including the winner, which was direct from a corner. An Olympic goal, I believe they call it in South America. Then Manchester United lost 2-0 to Reading. Again, both goals from set pieces. That was a big shock. And that meant that Man City against Arsenal, which seemed like, you know, the only show in town, ended up being even bigger than we would have thought because it meant the winner was suddenly back in the title race they seemed to not be in. And the loser really had no chance of getting back in it. And Manchester City won 2-1, deservedly 2-1. Chloe Kelly was the best player. Got 2 assists, and it's a really big week coming up as well because it's Chelsea-Arsenal Wednesday night and then the Manchester derby on Friday night. So, yeah, biggest week of the season, it seems.
Huge. Well, there'll be an even deeper dive into WSL on Offside Rule WSL edition. Back to the Premier League. A Saturday afternoon, quite the encounter at St James's Park between Newcastle and Southampton. Southampton, of course, have been beaten 9-0, as you probably saw midweek by Man United, and their plans for a morale-boosting comeback didn't really last long. They went 3-1 down in the first half with Newcastle once again playing very much on the front foot. Jan Bednarek, who'd been relieved of his red card suspension from Wednesday, again, though, scoring an own goal, although it was actually attributed to the Newcastle player. And then, a little bit like at Old Trafford, there was a tremendously dramatic second-half comeback from Saints.
Yeah, shout out to Minamino on loan from Liverpool. This was his first start. Played kind of inside left. They were playing quite positively. Great goal. Also, he got Hendrik sent off. Hendrik put a heavy one in on him early doors, you know, welcome, and then pulled him back in midfield. I mean, quite a brainless sending off, in my opinion. But I thought he sort of lost his way slightly in the second half because I think the entire Southampton team just got a little bit confused when they were being actually faced with 9 men in the end. And I think this is what Hasenhüttl was talking about after the game. Look, they showed us how to play against 9 men. We didn't do it right. And I think actually defending with 9 men came quite naturally to Newcastle because that's how they naturally play. So 2 banks of 4, closed down all the spaces. I think they were actually quite comfortable doing it and pretty comfortably saw the game out.
All right. Daniel, you enjoyed the Minamino goal.
Yes, it was. I think I described it as a mirror image of Batigol against Arsenal in that he just kind of runs to the edge of the box and then lashes it into the top of the net. It hits the top of the net before it hits the back of the net. It was a lovely, lovely goal. I mean, fair play to Newcastle because they kind of won that game twice. They did play that front foot attacking football and then they went back to what what they've grown to know over the last 18 months. And it served them really, really well, because it was a completely brainless move from Hendrick to get himself sent off. But yeah, they were really gutsy. And shout out to players like Miguel Almiron, who was so gutsy. Mm. You know, we don't necessarily expect that from him, but everyone kind of clubbed in, which suggests that although many fans are not particularly happy, I don't think the players have given up at all. They were really, really gutsy and determined in that last 10 minutes. And they did get a little bit lucky, but Carl Darlow might well be in the next England squad. I think he probably deserves it, because he's been phenomenal this season. He made another couple of great saves.
Yeah, indeed. It's nice to see Almiron coming good, actually, because it's been a tough time for him.
Mm.
South American arriving there and Tyneside and echoes of that magnificent film Goal, and you know, struggling to live up to the kind of career arc that I can't remember what the character's name was, but anyway, also at this time last week we were talking about Graham Jones's impact on Newcastle. Another new arrival making a pretty immediate impression here with Joe Willock as well.
It's the one thing they didn't have in the squad is they have central midfielders who central midfield, in that they try and pay passes from their position, which is Shelby, or they do what Isaac Hayden does, which is just try and break up play. And Jeff Hendrick kind of does a bit of both. What they don't have is a midfielder that looks to push on and get into the box. And that's exactly how Willock scored the first goal, with that kind of late run into the box that I guess Southampton maybe just weren't expecting, because Newcastle haven't done that of late, because they just haven't had the player.
Hmm.
Also, Bednarik got completely done on that first one. And just looking at Bednarik's performance, has he become a bit of a liability? Because just so many errors in the last few games. I mean, and even, you know, I think it was a 50-50, obviously, when he charged down Cher, but there was a little bit, I thought, heavy, a little bit desperate the way he kind of went in to block that shot. So is that actually a problem for Southampton now?
Yeah, they've been missing so, and they can't afford to miss many. And Walker Peters is still out. Vestergaard played his first game since Christmas. Romeo played his, I think, third game since December the 19th or something. So they've just missed a lot of players, which maybe has kind of increased the pressure on him, and maybe he's kind of struggled to cope with that a little bit.
Mm. They've now lost five consecutive top flight games for the first time since September 1998. Duncan Alexander also noting that they've conceded more goals in the Premier League in the last 12 days than Chelsea did in the whole of the 2004-05 season. So there's that. They're off at Molineux midweek playing Wolves. They also face Wolves next weekend in the league.
Oh, God.
Yeah. What?
Oh, I mean, Southampton are badly out of form, and Wolves are really difficult watch at the moment, so good luck to anyone who manages both of those games. That's
okay. Wolves, who had a challenging 0-0 with Leicester. Alex Cooney watched it. He says, is Pedro Neto the best outside the top six player and the player people thought Adama Traore was going to be? Neto was pretty watchable in this game, no?
Yeah, he was probably the best Wolves player. What I will say is I didn't realise he was still only 20. He's a really kind of mature winger.
He's swarthy.
But yeah, he is. But he's quite mature. You know, he's not someone like Everett Chiesa. There's a kind of sprinkling of youth that's very obvious in how they play, kind of, you know.
Insouciance.
Exactly that. Whereas Neto is a really accomplished winger, and he did Johnny Evans a couple of times. And actually, I mean, I know Ricardo Pereira has not played much football recently, but he really penned back Ricardo Pereira, which is exactly what Wolves needed, because I think if Pereira had managed to get forward and overlap, Leicester would probably won the game.
Hmm. All right, they didn't though. It was 0-0, and we'll see what happens with them and Saints midweek, and then again at the weekend. Villa, just the one goal for them. Ollie Watkins again, Arsenal's defence again in Saturday's matchday opening fixture with the Gunners at Villa Park.
Yeah, funny game. I mean, Villa went ahead so early and were relatively content to sit on that lead. Arsenal, I thought, you know, I've said this very basic analysis a couple of times before, but they've kind of got three players that are threatening. One is Saka, one is Tierney, and the third is Aubameyang. And they're without two of them until Aubameyang came on in the centre forward role, where I really don't think he's very effective, actually. I much prefer him coming from the left.
Really?
Yeah, I think in a possession side, when he has to play with his back to goal and link play, he's quite ineffective, actually. I know a lot of people don't like him from the left, but I do think Arteta's been right to generally go with him from that side. Yeah.
Who does play the centre-forward role for Arsenal, do you think?
Well, I think Lacazette offers more in the build-up play. He's frustrating, Lacazette, because there's some games where he really looks like he's able to make it work. And there's other games where he's just very peripheral, and this was one of them, really. I didn't necessarily think that Arteta got his changes right, actually. I thought he probably could have left Lacazette on here. I also didn't really see the need for Willian when it could have been Ceballos coming on when Thomas Partey went off. Arsenal kind of, they're not playing dreadfully at any point, but they've been quite frustrating. And when you think they've taken a step forward, they then put in a display like this. But
all right, well, yeah. Villa several steps forward. Traore pouncing on the mistake by Cedric here to then set up Ollie Watkins, who's now got four goals in his last five top flight appearances. That move, of course, sparked by a lovely ball upfield from the former Arsenal keeper Emiliano Martinez.
Yeah, I'm not quite going to go hot take enough to say that Ollie Watkins is a more important player to Villa than Jack Grealish, but he's hell of an important player at Villa. He does so much work off the ball, and I didn't quite realise this, but since the start of last season, he's missed 10 minutes out of a possible 6,300 in league football.
Good Lord.
Which, given his energy and his kind of constant running, he's Villa's second highest chance creator this season, which is pretty impressive for a lone striker who's kind of expected to, you know, some lone strikers would stay central maybe, particularly in their first season in the Premier League, and just kind of wait for service. But he does so much running off the ball. I think he's been brilliant this season.
The kind of 10-second analysis that a colour commentator will give in the course of a Villa game is that the difference between their pretty abject last season, staying up by the skin of their teeth on the final day, and this magnificent campaign they're on at the moment, is the arrival of a Watkins figure, the fact that it gives them a centre-forward. Is that fair, or are there other bigger things beyond that?
Well, I think what he does really well in the games I've watched is he runs that left channel really well, which obviously either drags out a centre-back or means a full-back has to kind of keep one eye on him. And that's exactly where Grealish then pops up, probably in a little bit more space than he might normally have. So yeah, I fully agree. I mean, I'm trying to wrap my brains who started up front for them most often last season, and I can't even think. So yes, that probably makes your point.
Villa doing the double over Arsenal for the first time in 28 years, since, in fact, the inaugural season of the Premier League. Who was their manager back then, and where did they finish in the league in that campaign?
Third.
You think you can answer questions third? Like that? No, it wasn't third.
Big Ron and second.
Yeah. Second, oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
If you find questions like that intriguing, you should probably take part in one of the 31 football quizzes across February and March that The Athletic is running in partnership with Prostate Cancer UK. They're all themed per club. So, I mean, for more of that kind of thing, check out the Villa one. Anyway, you can get all the details at theathletic.com/PCUK.
You're listening to The Totally Football Show, sponsored by Paddy Power and part of The Athletic Podcast Network.
We haven't mentioned Burnley 1-1 Brighton. Who wants to bang on this? Good result for Burnley.
I came away thinking it's probably the best 90 minutes I've seen from Burnley for a long time.
Okay.
And then realised I probably haven't seen Burnley for 90 minutes that much this season. But it was quite fun because, I mean, Brighton, I thought, really deservedly beat Tottenham, were very good and very well organised against Liverpool. But they're really hanging on here, particularly in the second half. And it just shows, I think, the value and the entertainment of having someone like Burnley in the league who do play a completely different way and ask questions of a Brighton side who, you know, against Liverpool actually looked very strong and very big physically, but when they came up against Burnley, they look a little bit overwhelmed. And it was quite funny watching Sanchez, who I think has been a really good addition to the Brighton side, has obviously taken over from Matt Ryan and goal, but you know, he was having to do tasks he was very unaccustomed to, just high balls and physical challenges and strikers leaving their boot in. It was a very classic kind of English football game in February, I think. But I genuinely think Burnley played well and were unfortunate not to win. I think if you're relying on Vidra for your goals, you're going to struggle in that respect.
Indeed. Brighton emerge unbeaten in five now. They'll both be in action in the Cup, the fifth round midweek. All right then, 16 teams left in the competition. Guarantee of quality is that 12 of them are from the Premier League. We've got five all Premier League clashes, which are always the favourite. Man United taking on West Ham, Everton Spurs, Leicester Brighton, Wolves Saints, Barnsley Chelsea, Sheffield United Bristol City, Burnley Bournemouth, and Swansea Man City. If you choose just one to watch, which is probably not an unreasonable approach, which one would you go for?
I'd go for Swansea Manchester City. You're right to point out that the all Premier League ties are not the appetising ones. But no, Swansea are playing really good football at the moment under Steve Cooper, who I must point out is Welsh, not English. Reiterate that. He's got a really nice backstory in that he was with England under 16s and I think England under 17s, but kind of came through that system of this kind of new type of British coach or English coach in terms of the English coaching system anyway. And he's doing a fantastic job because Swansea are punching way above their weight. They kind of outclassed Norwich on Friday night, who are still top of the league and are favourites to go up. And I just really hope that them and Brentford go up this season, I have to say, because Norwich got 21 points last season and only scored 26 goals, I think. And for them to go back up as champions would just feel like there was a bit of a chasm between the Premier League and Championship. So, yeah, good on him.
Do you think they can give City a game of it? Two seasons ago, they met in the Cup and it was 3-2 to City, but they were 2-0 down at half-time and it was Aguero with an 88th-minute winner. So something like that would be pretty good entity.
Yeah, they're not quite playing that the similar style, but I tell you what they have got. They've got Conor Hourihan in midfield from Villa, who is one of those players that probably just isn't quite good enough for the Premier League, but looks absolutely must in the Championship, quite frankly. He looks brilliant.
All right, lovely stuff, Daniel. That's bought Michael and Sasha enough time to pick out a fixture themselves. Sasha?
Yeah, I found the previous round of the FA Cup quite disappointing. Not a single upset in 16 games. I'm not really expecting any upsets in this one. So therefore, I will go for the boring all Premier League tie, Everton-Spurs. Because I think, you know, again, good opportunity for Ancelotti to have a nice FA Cup run. And I think in Mourinho's situation, he has to go and try to get something in the FA Cup as well. So I expect that would be quite a humdinger of a tie, I think, on Wednesday night.
Yeah. Michael, you wrote a piece this week about the evolution of Carlo Ancelotti's tactics. That's on The Athletic, of course.
Yeah, it should be up there on Wednesday. So you've done very well to know about that, James.
No, I mean, I'm across. I'm very much in the loop. Just tease us with some nugget or, you know, what's the hook? What's the pitch?
Well, I guess the interest, I mean, you remember, James, he started off obviously as, you know, assistant to Sacchi and was very much Sacchi in terms of
4-4-2.
Yeah, and dispensing with, you know, Zola and didn't want Baggio and didn't want these number 10 figures.
Crazy.
And then he became the manager who was, you know, the go-to manager if you were a side like Chelsea or Real Madrid and you wanted to indulge all these wonderfully talented playmakers.
Yeah, because I mean, rarely has there been such a kind of a voltifaccio, if you like, of a tactical disposition from that strict orthodoxy of the 4-4-2 to that ridiculous Milan side where you had, was it four number 10s in there? Where you had Pirlo, Rivaldo, Rui Costa and Kaká all in the same side.
Yeah, well, usually stayed off for Rivaldo because Rivaldo didn't get much of a look in, did he? But yeah, rotating band of, incredible. I mean, and also that was a time when not many sides in Europe and not just in Italy played real possession football. So he really placed his faith in, especially Pirlo, I think it was obviously the main one really to play him in that deep role. I think was one of the most influential decisions any manager's made in.
Although they say that wasn't him, that was Carlo Mazzoni.
They say it was Mazzoni, I know, but doing it for Brescia and doing it for Milan is
that's a little true. Different. But it's funny. I mean, I guess this is the point of your piece. If you were to say to him, I mean, I wouldn't know anyway, but I think if you ask a lot of people what is Ancelotti's shape or tactics now, I think they'd struggle a bit.
Yeah, well, it's been interesting watching him at Everton, actually, because obviously last year he played a pretty strict, like really early days Ancelotti 4-4-2 because he didn't have anyone who merited the number 10 role. And obviously now James has come in and the system he played against Manchester United was just completely based around James. I didn't think particularly effectively. But yeah, he's an interesting coach. I think someone who he just puts the players first, doesn't he? He now completely believes in indulging star individuals over the real importance of the system. So, he's a manager I've always enjoyed watching his teams over the years.
Okay, well, an interesting touchline deal with Jose Mourinho. Of course, a battle of former Real Madrid managers there on Wednesday. That'll be fun. Also that evening is the Man United West Ham game. Would that be your pick, Michael?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, I agree with Sasha. Everton, Spurs probably leaps out. I also quite like Barnsley Chelsea just because it reminds me of when they met in 2008 and Barnsley won 1-0. And it was like one of the great kind of FA Cup shock days because it was the same day that Manchester United got put out by Portsmouth. And it felt like Manchester United and Chelsea just got to the final of everything at that point. And just to have those two upsets in on the same Saturday, I think it was, I just remember really enjoying that day. And it set up this really weird semi-final quartet of West Brom, Portsmouth, Barnsley and Cardiff, which was just absolutely mad. I should say that Chelsea and Barnsley have already met this year in the EFL Cup. And Chelsea won 6-0, so it probably won't be an upset this time.
Man United West Ham, by the way, if this in any way influences your decision, won't be featuring Jesse Lingard because United are his parent club. You can buy a J-Lings face mask. Did you know that? £12 at jlings.com. J-Lings with a Z.
Any delivery charges or?
Yeah. I don't know, is she?
Fair enough.
I mean, it's not going to be a big package, a J-Lings face mask. I don't know if the tongue will be, maybe there's a hole for you to put your tongue out while you're doing the goal celebration.
Slightly, it would have to, surely a fake tongue would be better.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, we should say that the masks are to raise money for NHS charities.
Oh, brilliant.
So all the money goes there.
Oh, nice one. Hey, how about Man United or, you know, on loan Man United forward players raising money for vital services? Yeah, there you go. Nice one, J-Lings. Anyway, very shortly, we'll be testing Sasha's knowledge about the European leagues and more things like that. But first of all, let's get some odds from Lee Price from Paddy Power.
Hey, Jimbo, it's Lee. Lee Price, the annoying guy from Paddy Power. Hey, long time no speak. Anyway, listen, I know you're busy hanging out with strong men or one of your projects outside of the podcast, but I just want to drop you a note on my segment tonight. Basically, I can't be bothered. So can you just reference the fact that Paddy Power paid out a Man City win in the league before the weekend, point out that Leeds was on to beat Palace, obviously, and that United odds on to beat West Ham, less obviously, and then maybe just fill the rest of the slot with that Martin Tyler sound effect. Oh, his poor wife. Thanks, mate. Please answer my calls one day soon. Miss you. Love you. Bye.
You can find out these odds and more at paddypower.com or the Paddy Power app. Prices are accurate at the time of recording. It's over 18s only. Terms and conditions apply. And when the fun stops, stop. What else can you listen to this week, listener? Well, also out today, I think, is the Totally Football League show. Then there's the Totally Scottish Football show. That's on Tuesday. Offside Rule, WSL edition later in the week. European show, Totally Football show, European show. That's out on Tuesday as well with Julien Laurence and Raphael Honigstein, Alvaro Romeo and James Horncastle. James will be going big on Serie A where it is Milan still. It is Zlatan still. Juve bubbling under there. Liga, Barca had a bit of a scare at Betis. We'll hear about that from Alvaro. Remarkable thing about the Bundesliga weekend, as you probably saw, Sasha, was that there were no draws. No draws. They went commando.
I thought the scary thing about that league was that Borussia Dortmund and Borussia Mönchengladbach both lost as well. And they're in terrible runs of form.
Gladbach are going to be facing Man City in the Champions League in about 10 days' time. RB Leipzig, of course, who did win this weekend, are up against Liverpool. And you may have seen the news, I think confirmed this weekend, that the away game for Liverpool of that, which can't be held in Germany because Germany's got a block on all visitors from the UK at the moment, is now going to be held in Budapest. Alessio Di Maria saying, is it fair that Leipzig have to play their Champions League home game in Budapest, but then Liverpool get proper home advantage at Anfield in the second leg? Where, to be fair, Alessio, they're losing every single game they play at the moment. Should it just be a one-legged match in the best interests of fairness? It's unusual that they went for Budapest, but Liverpool still play at home. In inverted commas,
I think it's unfair in a way that Germany have stricter rules on this. So why do Leipzig have to suffer? I actually agree with this. Maybe both games should have been played at neutral venues, but then again, that's extra travel. I saw that I think one option they considered was Spurs Stadium, which would have worked obviously for Liverpool, but with Leipzig traveling in and out of UK, again, given their rules, I think it probably was undesirable for them. And, you know, Budapest is just closer.
Yes. Okay. Well, Champions League getting back underway in about 10 days' time with all of that. PSG will be taking on Barcelona. PSG, did you see they were involved in the Classique Sunday night, a 2-0 win. Did you see Icardi's header on this?
Yes. Very loopy.
Yeah, but it was Chicharito-esque in that he nodded it backwards with the back of his head. Remarkable technique. Anyway, all very exciting.
3 points behind PSG are AS Monaco. And what did they do?
Yes.
They beat bottom of the table Nîmes 4-3. And Alexander Golovin, the Russian midfielder there for them, scored a hat-trick, which doesn't happen very often for Russian players in top in major European leagues. So big news back
home. When was
the
last time, Sasha?
Pogrebniak for Fulham almost 9 years ago. Yeah, I know. you laugh, but just not very good at football, are we?
No, Monaco doing brilliantly under Niko Kovac.
Yeah.
And very much making a go of it in that remarkably open for a Liga title race there. We'll be talking about all of that on Tuesday. I mean, all this talk of Leipzig having to shift their base, it's really not that long until the Euros are meant to be coming around. A lot can change between now and then, but there was a lot of kerfuffle about 10 days ago when UEFA appeared to confirm that it's still going to be held in 12, or the plan is still to hold it in 12 different European venues. But I noted that afterwards they did kind of row back a little bit and said, that's our plan. But obviously we've got another option if things don't work out. And we're hoping that vaccines and other things change the situation between now and then. It is an evolving state of affairs. Anyway, there you go. Anything else you want to add, Sasha or Michael or Daniel, before we let our listener go?
A couple of shout-outs. First shout-out, Mesut Özil. Got his dream move to Fenerbahce. They hosted Galatasaray at the top of the table clash in Turkey on Saturday night, and they lost 1-0. So Galatasaray are now top. So unhappy Özil. However, who was happy was Fernando Muslera, who is back from a double leg break. I think it was back end of last season. It was after lockdown. And he was back, and they've now won all 5 games for Galatasaray that he played, only conceded 2 goals, and he was quite an emotion. There was quite an emotional tribute to his mother, who passed away a few months ago after the match.
So when you say a double leg break, it was the same leg broken in 2 places?
Yeah, tip fib.
Legs?
No, tip fib. So it's like both bones in the leg. He was really, really unfortunate. And yeah, it's just, it's a bad one, but I think if they could pin it, he's back in 7 months. It kind of makes sense. But fair play to him. He did well. Another shout out to André-Pierre Gignac. He is now in the final of the club, of the FIFA Club World Cup, because he scored a penalty today against Palmeiras. So I think they're going to be...
Who for, Sasha?
Tigres. For Tigres.
He's still with Tigres.
Yeah, Tigres. Okay. Sixth season there. And, you know, he's...
I think Liga MX.
Exactly. And he seems to be having a good time there, mid-30s in the final. You know, he's a bit of a legend. I think he's... Basically, his career in Mexico, he's outscored his previous career in France now. And he seems to be having a lovely time.
Wouldn't it be nice if kind of football journalism had a similar kind of career arc where you put in your years earning the big money, say, following Premier League sides, but then can go and enjoy a kind of golden semi-retirement in, say, Mexico or perhaps, you know, Buenos Aires.
Kind of depends how you define big money, I suppose. But yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I suppose being sports exists for that, you know?
Couldn't possibly.
Maybe a little bit. Yeah. I'm afraid. Anyway. Okay, well, thanks for that, Sasha. And then thanks for your participation today, and Michael and Daniel as well. We'll wrap it up here. We're back, as I say, with the Tuesday European show, and then on Thursday with a look at all the FA Cup action. For now, many thanks for being with us, listener, and we'll catch up with you soon. Cheerio.
You've been listening to The Totally Football Show, part of the Athletic Podcast Network. Keep up to date with everything Totally at thetotallyfootballshow.com and follow us at The Totally Show on Twitter and Insta. Check out all of The Athletic's football podcasts on Apple, Spotify and all the usual places, or listen ad-free on the Athletic app. The Totally Football Show is a Muddy Knees Media production and sponsored by Paddy Power.
The Athletic.